Hello and welcome. I'm Mary Jo Foley, the Editor-in-Chief here at Directions on Microsoft. I'm your host for the series of podcasts for those interested in the Microsoft Enterprise IT ecosystem. It's time for our annual Microsoft Roadmap update, where we bring together the team of Directions analysts to assess the current year in terms of all things Microsoft Enterprise related and to make predictions for the next. This is not one of our usual podcasts. Instead, it is a recording of our year-end webinar from December 5th, 2024. We are also including the participant questions and answers that we handled live during the event. Enjoy!
The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us today. My name is Nikki Salisbury, and I'll be facilitating today's webinar. Directions members may download this presentation at www.directionsonmicrosoft.com/slides. This presentation is being recorded for on-demand viewing and will be available next week on the members portal. All lines have been placed on mute, so if you have a question, please enter it into the question panel and we'll do our best to get to as many as possible at the end of the presentation. The topic for today is our annual Microsoft Roadmap update. It's being presented by a panel of Directions on Microsoft analysts, and it's being led by Directions Editor-in-Chief, Mary Jo Foley. Take it away, Mary Jo.
Thank you so much, Nikki. Welcome, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us today. As Nikki said, my name's Mary Jo Foley. I am the Editor-in-Chief here at Directions. So today in our annual Roadmap webinar, we're going to follow a script that worked very well for us last year. We're going to have the analysts give us their hot takes on some of the issues they've been following in 2024 and they think will matter to enterprise customers in 2025. One of my jobs here during this webinar is keeping the analysts on schedule. And backed by popular demand is my trusty gong, which has been in hibernation for the past year just for this purpose. Here is what you will hear if someone goes on a little too long in their presentation. Analysts, please keep it short and sweet. After our panel of analysts presents, we are going to do a lightning round where I will ask the panelists a few more questions of my own, and then it will be your turn for questions. But first, let's talk about Directions. For those not familiar with Directions on Microsoft, we are an independent IT planning, information, and advisory service focused exclusively on Microsoft Enterprise technologies, and we've been in business since 1992. By independent, we mean we don't work for Microsoft and we don't speak for Microsoft. Our only mission is to track Microsoft changes and provide impartial facts and informed insights that our customers need to evaluate, plan for, and purchase when they're going for Microsoft products and services. So we have many different Directions products and services. We have detailed reports, we have evaluation kits, we have on-premises and cloud-based roadmaps, and we have our world-famous licensing boot camps and negotiation service. Okay, let's start with our panel. I'm going to go alphabetically by analysts, and I'm going to introduce them first to all of you. So we have today on our panel, Barry Briggs, who covers corporate governance and CXO topics for Directions. We have Michael Cherry, who covers Windows Client. We have Jim Gaynor, who covers collaboration, servers, and infrastructure. Rob Helm, who covers Office Apps, Exchange, and SharePoint. Wes Miller, who covers identity, security, and systems management. Rob Sanfilippo, who covers Copilots, Azure, Power Platform, GitHub, and databases, and Andrew Snodgrass, who covers data analytics, CRM, and ERP. We also have on our call today our newest rehire, analyst Greg DiMichele, who is on today's call. He's not going to present, but he will be overseeing compute and data infrastructure for us here at the company. Okay, let's go right into the panel and start with Barry Briggs. Barry, what do you think mattered most in the Microsoft Enterprise world in 2024? And what's going to be top of mind for customers in 2025?
Well, thanks, Mary Jo. So I had a couple of things here. First of all, I think Azure AI Search is unheralded, but it's amazing. And in the past few years, we've all learned the value of vector databases for RAG, or retrieval augmented generation applications, which allow you to connect public LLMs like GPT with enterprise data. Azure AI Search uniquely supports traditional keyword-based search, vector search, released last year, and combinations of both called hybrid mode. It's actually pretty powerful and pretty differentiated. The integrated vectorization feature in preview at Ignite, which is a wizard-based approach to creating a vector index, this looks like it could greatly simplify the work of creating such applications and really help AI spread quickly. Still got some rough edges, but it's promising. Azure IoT operations. As I've claimed before, IoT and Edge are very strategic for Microsoft. And it's an area where Microsoft is way ahead of their competitors. And I believe that manufacturing firms are approaching a tipping point. They want to rid themselves of old style OPC controllers and the like. And they now have a state of the art cloud managed Edge system, which went GA at Ignite, in which they can deploy modern protocols, local logic, AI, and they can manage with Arc. This is a big deal. Why? Because Edge devices are really entrenched. Switching costs once you get them into a factory are super high. Purview continues to expand its purview. I've said, also stated before, that Purview, which is the regulatory compliance suite, kind of flying under the radar. But again, it's an area where Microsoft is far ahead of the other cloud providers. Now, regulatory compliance like e-discovery, data protection, insider trading, these are problems for every single company on the planet. And unlike the other clouds, Microsoft continues to invest heavily, and for good reason, you need it. But you need E5 to get the good stuff. And finally, silicon. Microsoft, as we're seeing, is at last investing in custom silicon with an AI accelerator called Maia, an ARM-based CPU called Cobalt, which went GA in October, and a data processing network acceleration hardware called Azure Boost. Still, they are years behind AWS and Google here. AWS has had ARM-based Graviton for several years, Nitro, their hardware-based hypervisor for several years. They've had AI acceleration chips called Inferentia and Trainium. Google, of course, has tensor processing units, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, they're now in version 5. So, well, Microsoft has taken important steps forward. I think they still have some catch-up to do. Back to you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. Let's go on with Michael Cherry, who is going to tell us what he thinks is going on in the wonderful world of Windows.
So where I'd like to start is talking about the large number of Windows 10 devices that are still around and are, I think, going to start to cause problems for all of us, even if we've moved on to the currently supported versions. I think every company should have an ESU strategy if you have Windows 10 devices still in use after October 2025. And you have to keep in mind that it's very unlikely, in my opinion, that consumers will pay $30 for an ESU. So there's going to be lots of unpatched Windows 10 machines in the universe that are ready to be taken over and used to launch attacks at those of us who are up to date. I also think it's important while we look in here and say Windows 10, not to obsess about the number that's assigned to Windows. In a lot of my work, I'm trying just to talk about Windows and what is the current version. So don't obsess about what or whether or if there will be a Windows 12. Microsoft will continue to make changes to Windows. Don't obsess about what the name or number assigned to those will be, but rather have a strategy to be operating on the currently supported version or, you know, N minus one of the currently supported versions. So both of those are supported, right? It would be like being on 23H2 or 24H2. Those are both supported versions. I think organizations should have a remote and cloud desktop strategy for Windows that makes sense for your organization. If you're using remote desktops and you're using them on locally with Windows Server, or you're using Windows 365 or Azure Virtual Desktop, and likely what makes sense for most organizations, I used to come at this thinking there was one, you know, you would be using one and you would use it everywhere. Now I think it's actually knowing how to have the right mix of local remote desktops on Windows Server maybe some on Azure Local or Azure HCI, I guess is now called Azure Local, and where you should have Windows 365. I also think that you should look at the Windows 365 link box. That might, if it holds true to what they say it can do, it might simplify having to manage two desktops, a virtual and a physical desktop for each user of remote desktops. And then I think one of the biggest disappointments for me, and I don't think it's going to get any better, is Windows Copilot. You should understand Windows Copilot runtime. That's what you need if you're going to build applications that process any kind of data for AI purposes locally. But don't have any real expectations for Windows Copilot. I had hoped we would see some sort of a Copilot that could help you tune and configure and secure Windows, you know, at the local level. But that seems to have been kind of put on some sort of back burner. And I don't think Windows will have very much of a Copilot future. So that's what I'm sort of looking at and thinking about as we go forward into the next year.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael. Next up, we have Jim Gaynor, who has some observations on big picture trends that he thinks are going to affect Microsoft Enterprise customers.
Hey, thanks. One thing I think, and you've probably all seen this too, if it's not AI with Microsoft right now, it's everything else. And the time I've been following Microsoft, I've regularly watched the company shift from what they treated as the favored child, their strategic technology or platform that was going to change everything. You know, Teams and hybrid work was the latest. Remember how that was really big up until the end of 2022. But remember when it was, you know, HoloLens and mixed reality, or it was chatbots or blockchain, or every single thing is going to be containerized in Windows Server containers. And it's shifted, but I haven't seen anything like what they're devoting right now to generative AI in terms of the number of services, how they're rubbing it on everything. And frankly, they're just vast hardware and data center investments to the point that it's really impacting their ability and in some cases desire to deliver on things in a timely or complete way. And we talked about this in a recent podcast, me and Mary Jo and Wes. And I really think as long as this continues, I mean, other people here will talk about AI and what it can do, but it's sucking all the air out of the room. And as long as this trend continues of Microsoft, beating many, many drums about AI, if the thing you want from Microsoft isn't related to AI, don't have high expectations for it. It's not a strategic initiative. They'll let those schedules slip. So think about that. Another thing is that pay to check your bags. Microsoft has learned from the airlines that model of charging you for every little thing a la carte is profitable. If they can't get you to buy E5, and even if they can, add-ons and premium tiers or services are becoming more and more common. And again, we talked about this with our batteries not included reports and webinars, and it's continuing. You've got things like Teams Premium. You've got Copilot, which is an add-on. It doesn't come with anything else. Hot patching in Windows Server for Windows Server 2025. It's not included. Even if you've got SA, you've got to pay an extra subscription fee on top of that. So just like with the airlines, these all-inclusive suites from Microsoft are out and charging you a fee for every little comfort, every little thing that makes life easier and easier to manage is in. And so expect that the most significant improvements in services and products used from Microsoft will continue to come with additional costs as they try to up their average revenue per user. And lastly is perpetual's dead. It's the parrot in the skit, you know, it's pining for the fjords. Microsoft would like to be totally be done with it, but you know, hey, we've got long-term servicing channel, things are going to be around for a while. It's not new. Microsoft's been pushing customers to subscription or pay-as-you-go services for years, but even the last holdouts of perpetual licensing are going away. We've got the new versions of Exchange and Skype for Business Server coming later in 2025, and they'll join Project Server in requiring SA. That is a subscription. You can't just buy it and forget it. And all the add-ons I mentioned about checking your bags come as subscriptions, even if they're added to things like Windows Server. Now, you know, some companies, you can make this work for your favor. If you like moving everything from CapEx to OpEx, that can be good. It can change how you do things. But it means that the old mental mindset of, hey, I'm going to buy a bunch of servers that I keep in my own data center or colo, and I'm going to buy these licenses, and I'm going to treat that as a capital expenditure that depreciates over 3 to 5 years. And if budget times are tight, I can just sit on it and wait through another upgrade cycle. That's gone. Microsoft is, you know, there's some time left in it, but it's going away. And that model, while it may have been useful, you know, Microsoft isn't going to let you do it. And instead, they're going to try to get you to those subscriptions, and it'll lock you into paying something all the time and not give you that weird flexibility that you could have before. Mary Jo?
Thank you, Jim. All right. Up next, we have Rob Helm, who has been keeping an eye on Office client and server products and services lately. So, Rob, what's going on in your world?
Immortality, Mary Jo. I saw a quote that made me think of my beat the other day. It was a famous movie maker, best left unnamed, and he had this line: "I don't hope for immortality through my work. I hope for immortality by not dying." And Outlook and Exchange seem to have kind of similar hopes. You know, they 5 years ago, I was expecting Microsoft by now to have totally ramped up spending on Teams, which, and have shrunk it on Outlook and email to the point at Exchange where Outlook and Exchange would just be these tiny little vestigial things, you know, like whale legs or something. Instead, we're getting a new Outlook completely built on Outlook web app, but with the same client platform as Teams, which among other things means that new features that Microsoft brings to Teams, like AI features, can also go into Outlook. And Outlook, the new version that is going to be a platform for a lot of its own AI features as well. Even the old classic Outlook, the one that dates back thousands and thousands of years, Rob Sanfilippo can tell you more exactly, is getting a few new features, and it seems likely to survive until at least 2029 by our estimates. As for Exchange Server, well, it's following the path to immortality that was forged by SharePoint, an eternal stream of subscription payments. Everybody needs to be on Exchange Server SE, the subscription version of the Exchange Server product, by the end of 2025, if they're running Exchange in their own data centers as opposed to or in a partner's data centers like Amazon. And because if you don't, you won't have Microsoft support and patches. And you want support and patches, because if there's one thing we've learned about Exchange and Exchange Server in the last few years, is that even very well-run Exchange organizations in Microsoft data centers, run by Microsoft themselves with direct calls to the product team, they can still get badly hacked. And as for customer-run Exchange servers, if you're out there after the end of 2025 on unsupported and not running the latest patches, well, those Exchange servers are going to have a short and exciting life.
Well put. Thank you, Rob. All right, next up we have Wes Miller, who has the daunting task of keeping up with security and identity related topics at Microsoft. Wes, what's going on?
The good news is nothing changes in those areas at Microsoft. No, I'm just kidding. So looking across the technologies that I cover and the licensing side as well, management identity and security, when you look at all of these services, the on-prem variants are all effectively, if not dead, dormant. So things like System Center, things like Configuration Manager, Identity Manager, all these technologies you can consider effectively dormant, and they're not going to last a terribly long time. So really, all roads lead to the cloud and services-based equivalents of those things, some for clients, some for servers. So it's a different story in both places. To that end, overall, on-prem infrastructure is all largely in maintenance mode. And I know I had some Microsoft employees balk when I said this, particularly about Active Directory because there were some improvements in Windows Server 2025. However, the technology is effectively done. It's out of the oven cooling. And lastly, just to sort of align with what Jim said, prices are up, budgets are down. Everybody at our boot camps, I hear a common message. Everybody's coming in chartered with pay less than you did last year. And Microsoft is telling everybody to pay more than they did last year and asking for more money for Copilot and Teams Premium and 1,001 other add-ons. So customers have to stop, focus, and really invest in Microsoft's technologies where ROI is available. And I also really encourage them to draw down investment in things like System Center, where Microsoft is not investing anything for them. So I guess that's the main thing is actually take it slow to speed up.
Okay. Next, thank you very much, Wes. Next, we have Rob Sanfilippo, who is going to talk all about Copilots and the dev goodness. Rob?
Thanks, Mary Jo. You know, Rob Helm called me out a few minutes ago about Exchange client history and what is a discussion of anything in software without getting nostalgic about some history. So I worked on Exchange Server since before it was called Exchange Server, before we knew what it was going to be named back in the early 90s. The first client was actually written by the Exchange Server team, was codenamed Capone, which was a nod to Chicago, which was the code name for Windows 95, we all remember. But the first version of Outlook was in 1997. That was by the Office team. So Office 97 included Outlook 97. So that's where it goes back to. But now we're seeing new things. Okay, onto the new stuff that I'm going to talk about is Copilot. Yeah, so we hear a lot about this, and it's starting to look like it's coming in waves. So in September, there was this Copilot Wave 2 for Copilot, Microsoft 365 Copilot. And several new things were introduced, but then we had Ignite in November, just last month, and there were more new things post wave two. So some of the big things, especially at Ignite, were this concept of agentic copilots that will run in the background and do things for you for assisting a user without having to be directly invoked. So I think we're going to see more around that. At GitHub, they're talking about GitHub Copilot having agentic elements to it as well. So an agent, for example, might be like a facilitator in Teams that keeps the meeting focused in the background and directs the conversations and chats and helps compile follow-up and action items at the end of a meeting. And then SharePoint agents are going to be like mini copilots that are tied to a particular site or directory in SharePoint that can give you information around that particular set of files or data that are in one site. So those are called SharePoint agents. You're gonna see the word agent a lot more. Another thing, pages. So that was announced in September, but this is really based on Loop, the Office application where you can share some work that you're doing together in a persistent way. So Copilot pages are a way of persisting some conversation around a project that you're working on. And then Copilot is part of that because you can talk to Copilot and have Copilot help you with the work as it goes on. And again, this thing persists. And then actions is another thing. These are like Outlook rules where you can say some particular thing happens when a certain type of mail comes in, it gets forwarded or it gets move to a folder. But imagine those are in a more broader way done by Copilot. So you can create rules around what Copilot does. And these are called actions. So that's another thing we've seen announced. So we're having these waves. So we just wonder what's next, but there's a lot coming and still work to be done on what has already been announced a year ago. But the next thing that leads into is Copilot Analytics, which is important. We've seen in first year of 365 Copilot, everyone's asking, yeah, but how do we measure the value of this? There's a few tools you can use this with today. Microsoft 365 Admin has that, a dashboard, and Viva Insights Copilot is dashboard. But Copilot Analytics goes further to really gather up this functionality and help you calculate the ROI around your Copilots. It ties these to your key performance indicators in your business, like what is the win rate, how many deals were created. You can see how Copilot was used to help you work on your KPIs. So that'll be interesting. That's Copilot Analytics. But the last thing I want to talk about is some old school software, SQL Server 25 and VS 2025. So SQL 2025 has been announced. It's in preview now, first preview, calling it a CTP. It's going to be generally available in 2025. But the major themes around this are AI, surprise. So there's going to be vector database support, and you'll be able to gain access to that through regular T-SQL. There's better security through Entra ID managed identities, improved performance, as there always is with every version of SQL Server, and particular query performance has some improvements coming. And then there's some integration with the new Fabric platform that Microsoft has in Azure, and then there's going to be more integration with Arc. But if you look at VS 2025, this hasn't been announced yet, so we've been wondering, when is the next major version of that, because 2022 is the current. But I think it's coming in 2025, even though it hasn't been announced, it's my guess. And I think we'll probably see some AI there too, both in developer productivity tools, where AI helps you out, but also just tools to help you build AI applications, especially like taking advantage of the Windows Copilot runtime that Michael talked about earlier.
All right. You are right on the edge of time, but you did.
Yeah, that's why I was starting to rush. I was still going to add, though, my question I have on the slide there is, could these be the final versions of those apps, the 2025 versions? Because, year-based versions of major releases are kind of going out of style, and they might turn into subscriptions or just an ongoing update. So that's something to look out for with these ones that are still lingering around SQL and Visual Studio.
All right. Up next, thank you, Rob. Up next, Andrew Snodgrass. What is interesting in the data space now and in the next year, Andy?
Well, it's funny on it is we'll get into some of the agentic AI stuff in a little bit here on the last one. But it'll start off in the Fabric world. I don't think they know what they're doing with the strategy for this service. Is it just keeps growing. Sometimes it feels like a cyborg to me that keeps grabbing parts and shoving it onto itself and trying to make it bigger than it was before. It came out just over a year ago, and Fabric now is expanding into making it itself available for more types of workloads and applications. They've added this new thing that's just coming out in preview, and it's called Fabric Databases. Now, you'd be confused immediately because there's already one link there. So what is this Fabric Databases? Well, what it is the ability to deploy a non-one link database, like a SQL Server database, through the Fabric UI. That doesn't mean that Fabric is holding a SQL Server database. No, what it's doing is it's actually integrated with the Azure SQL database service. And so it creates the database through that service, but it ties it all in for automatic integration so it can mirror itself or replicate itself into one lake. And then you can do analytics on the data that's in your SQL Server database. And it shares the security model and it shares the billing side. All right. So there's some things that are interesting in there, but it is very odd that you would create a transactional database from an analytics service and have it be the controller over this transactional production database. Anyway, so they're expanding Fabric out, trying to make it be more than it was before. All right, so still speaking on Fabric a little bit, let's talk about Power BI. Power BI I look at as a tale of two services. It has a dual life. And Microsoft's been struggling with the message. In fact, it's been pretty confusing this year about what Power BI still is now that Fabric is here. And if you listen to a lot of the Microsoft talk, they will tell you that everything about Power BI is tied up with Fabric. Okay? But that's not actually true. There are 6 deployment options for Power BI, from free to pro to premium EM to Fabric to Power BI Report Server and so on. Only one of those is dependent on Fabric. The other 5 don't care if Fabric exists or not. Right? And so from that standpoint, it's a confusing message. But if you're a Power BI user, don't worry about this. Fabric is still there. The only real concern is if you were a premium P user with a high-end Power BI side, then you're going to have to move into Fabric regardless. But the rest of you, the pros and everybody else, just sit back and relax. Now, on the Dynamics 365 side, they are adopting agentic AI, and I don't always say this, but I think they're doing a really good job of it, okay? Dynamics was an early adopter of Copilot, even before Copilot had a name, and they rebranded a bunch of insights and other ML-related stuff and called it Copilot, and I gave them a hard time about that. But now what they're doing is they're actually adopting the agentic AI copilot capabilities and showing how they can be done in Dynamics, and they're doing a really good job of it. Okay, they do things like, for example, they put an agent out there that watches email and other traffic and looks for certain types of data, like maybe an update from a vendor comes through on an email, and they'll take that information and it'll update POs and forecasts and other data within the system, and then show that to a human to say, hey, these are the things I was able to see automatically and that I've updated for you. Is this okay? And then the human says, yeah, that sounds great. And so it's kind of like having some kind of a cron job or an agent sitting in the background. And like what we would really like to do with Power Automate if we could do it without all the work. And so it's this nice monitoring tool. And I think they're doing a good job on that. But those are the big ones I've got.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Andy. I am getting ready to ask some questions of my own now. I don't have to present. I can just ask questions, which is great. The old reporter hat is on.
I have a question for you, though. Do we get to gong you?
Do you get to gong me?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. This is going to be a lightning round. So again, we're going to keep it short. If people go on too long with their answers, the gong will be sounded. My first question for the panel is all this AI stuff, copilots, agents, actions. Rob Sanfilippo is talking about all these different things. Do you think this is more in the realm of a gimmick, or is it the real deal? And I know that's an oversimplified question, but I think it's an important one. And I know Rob is ready to start, Rob Sanfilippo, but I'm going to have Andy go first and then Rob Sanfilippo.
Okay.
Okay. I think some of it is gimmicky. I think some of it is real. I think the natural language interface is nice. I think that the big issue, though, is that despite Microsoft's marketing, we need to reset our expectations of what this is actually going to do. You know, it would be lovely to go into Copilot and Word and say, can you modify these settings for me so I don't have to go dig down through the myriad of menu items and preferences and all the rest of that junk and try to figure out where it is I want my line wrapping to look right. Okay? It doesn't do that. It doesn't help us on day-to-day things. It does a nice job of summarization, kind of, and it can give some grammar suggestions most of the time, but it has to set your expectations on what this is. And it's not going to be an all-in solve all my problems with a particular product situation. It just doesn't have that capability. So, you know, if from that side, I think some of it's gimmicky, but I think some of it's beneficial. Rob.
Okay. That's cool. I agree. The first thing I was going to say is, yeah, I'm sure we all completely 100% agree on this, and that was going to be sarcastic. And it is sarcastic because we all have our views. But I agree a lot with what Andy said. This is all happening so fast, as we all know, this AI wave that's just began and just gone, taken over the industry and the world. And the things with the issue with Copilot announcements is that they're coming so fast that you don't have much time to understand the ones you saw 2 months ago. And now you already have brand new ones to look at. And by the time they hit the road and you actually get access to them, because these are in a staggered basis being introduced to clients, they've changed from what you saw in the demo. So you might think it was one thing and now it's a little bit changed, maybe for the better, but it's just always changing. So that's the thing you got to keep an eye on, is you can watch all these demonstrations at these conferences and just wonder, like, how is this really going to work? How am I going to use it? How is it going to change before it actually is in my hands? So I think that's the part of it that could be gimmicky, is that when you see it, it's not what you're going to really get. But then when you really get it, it probably is going to be better and more usable. But it's still very early. And so just watch and wait and just find what works for you now. And don't worry about adopting every single thing that you see coming out of the Copilot realm.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd say, you know, really kind of three things really quickly. One is that I agree with Rob. We're in the really early phases of this. This is a major software wave, and we're in it, and it's going to take enterprises years, I think, to actually prepare themselves to get their data houses in order, to set up all the permissions and the RBACs and the guardrails and so forth. And, you know, I think CISOs and compliance managers should learn all about how Purview tracks Copilot interactions, for example. I'll say myself, somewhat provocatively, I'm very skeptical about agentic AI. You know, I worked on Lotus Notes and agents in the early 90s. And anytime you abdicate control to something that's not deterministic, which AI is not, it's probabilistic, you run the risk of the wrong thing happening without your knowledge.
Right.
I'll just throw one thing in. I think the current state, a lot of this AI is, it's a really cool parlor trick. You know, write my email in iambic pentameter. But you know what's really powerful is when you get to the point where you can open up a window and say, what's up with the Dunder Mifflin account? And you have an AI agent that can look at your proprietary corporate data, can look at your Salesforce records, can look at your sales history, can look at the web and see that they just fired their CEO, and can synthesize that for you. But we're a long way from that, because of the things that, you know, Barry and Rob are just describing, right? How do I, all that requires touching huge amounts of my corporate data that's in 10 different data stores with 10 different permission models. And I think the AI vision is really exciting, but it always keeps coming back to, what's my strategy? Where is my data sitting? What are the kind of databases I'm in? Are they the right kinds? Do I have too many? Do I have too few? That work is essential. And if you can invest time in that now, you're going to be ahead of the game when these agents really are ready to do the kind of, you know, trolling through your corpus of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. That was Greg. Thank you, Greg.
I'd like to just briefly make a suggestion. And since we're talking about, I think there's a sweet spot for large language models and generative AI in general. First, you have to have a bunch of expert data. For natural language, that's not hard. We're all experts at speaking our own language and have been since we were 5 years old. But it can be very hard to find in other domains, like what Directions on Microsoft does, for example. And then the second thing you need is you need a structure that you're trying to build, and you need to know something about what that structure is. That's hard for natural language. We don't really know 100% how it's structured. But there are languages out there, like programming languages, that are highly structured, and the structure was designed by humans and lovingly documented in unreadable documents. I think that something like GitHub and its code generation are the absolute sweet spot where you're trying to generate code in a language that's widely used and where there's plenty of data available out there on the internet to learn from. I think anything more specialized or looser or less well understood in terms of the structures, that could be hard. For example, I thought about project management. But unless you do dozens and dozens of projects that all have a similar structure, I think it would struggle. So we may, what the limits of this are, a sweet spot are, we don't know yet. I agree with everybody else that it's very early, but there are some logical places to look first.
Yeah, that's a great point about code being a great language. I'm amazed at how productive I suck at Bash, but with Copilot and with ChatGPT, I'm writing more Bash scripts than I ever have in my life, and they work.
Nice. And you've even got Mark Rusinovich saying, okay, thanks to Copilot, I never have to relearn regex. So it's there. It's a good reference. One other thing I want to mention, and this is a mantra that organizations have heard long before AI, with any kind of thing that proposes to help get insights out of all the information you have, because that's what some of the best practical uses for all of this are going to be: get me my data and give me insights from my data, not going towards this mythical artificial general intelligence. You still got to organize your data. Mm-hmm. You still got to go through and get rid of your old data. Make sure the AI has, make sure your LLMs, your systems have access to the right data, that they can't access the wrong data and bring in information that users should not access, internal users, external users, that it should not get into confidential data. You have to manage your data. You have to organize your data to get real results out of this. And there's nothing out there that can do this messy work for you.
All right, I'm going to stop everyone. I know everyone wants to talk AI, but I want to talk about on-prem. So Jim said this in his presentation. He said perpetual is dead. So is on-prem really dead? Or as I put it, is it just resting with Azure Arc? And I'm sure Jim and Rob Helm would like to say some things here. Maybe Wes would as well.
I'd love to, since I had nothing to say about AI. I think that main thing, yes, it is. And no, it's not just resting. And sure, there's an Azure Arc tie-in. I think if we look across it, almost every legacy technology that Microsoft makes, from Windows Server to System Center, the things I mentioned, they are dormant. You're being asked to pay more than you ever have before, and you're getting less with each version than you did before it. So that's just the way it's going to be. And Microsoft is instead investing in cloud equivalents of those things for Azure, for servers, or for Microsoft 365 on the client side. So in general, they are just resting. But again, you're going to be asked to pay more. And per Jim's point, you're going to be paying for subscriptions for things like Subscription Edition. But that's just what it's going to be. And Azure Arc, it's just a way to get your on-prem infrastructure looped back into Azure. And it looks like probably paying for additional services on-prem. So it's just subscriptifying the stuff you already owned, even if you didn't want to. So that's the main thing. Yeah, he's right. It's no perpetual. It's all subscriptions.
Okay.
And I'm going to add, you look at what they Microsoft has said they were doing this when it comes to Windows Server. They said before, when they introduced Stack HCI, which is now called Azure Local, that they're focusing on making Windows Server your best of breed guest operating system. They aren't developing it. I mean, they're bringing in things that they did from previous versions of Stack HCI for virtualization in Windows Server 2025. There's some new stuff there, but for the most part, Windows Server is being focused on being a really, really good guest OS, an OS for VMs. And Azure Local, which is the rebranded name of Stack HCI, for now, they plan on adding more capabilities. That's what they're talking about using. If you do want to have stuff on premises, you want to have things in your own data center, you'd run Azure Local. You'd run your VMs in that. And guess what? Azure Local is meant to be connected to Azure. Meanwhile, they've deprecated WSUS. System Center is moribund. And what are the replacements for this stuff? Azure hosted services. Mm-hmm. Hey, you should be using AutoPatch. Hey, you should be using Intune. Those are the things they want you to use. And all the on-prem stuff that you would use to manage is just not there. It's still shuffling along. And as I mentioned before, you've got LTSC, things are going to be supported for 5, 10 years more, but that doesn't mean you're going to see any advances in it. And it doesn't mean that you can kick the can down the road too far, because when those 10 years are up, they're up.
Okay. Let's go to security.
Well, did Helm have anything for that one you mentioned?
Oh yeah, Rob Helm, did you want to add anything? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think in the end, there will still be a place for on-premises, not perpetually licensed, but on-premises technology. Particular security concerns, like we need to have physical control of it to certify that it's secure. And dare I say it, edge cases, where something, a piece of software actually has to be close to the edge of the network just because it has to respond quickly, or because you've got crappy connectivity. Imagine that. And so that's, if anything kills the new Outlook I was talking about earlier, it will be features that classic Outlook had for situations of poor connectivity that people still want.
Okay.
Yeah. And I agree with Helm on that. The on-prem mostly is dead. Perpetual definitely is. Licensing side of it, but there's still going to be these cases where there needs to be an on-prem. Dynamics is rife with that. Mm-hmm. Plants have to have local servers for monitoring equipment. Stores need to have local hardware for doing sales when connectivity is not there. There's lots of reasons why you need some kind of local device. It's not going to look like it was before, but there'll still be something there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, security. Microsoft says security is job number one. We keep hearing them say this, but is it really? And if it's not for them, how could or should it be? And I know Wes and Michael are going to have many things to say here.
No, it's not. Security is unfortunately still an afterthought. And I think all we have to do is look at the work that Microsoft has done with the Copilot runtime to see that. It's unfortunate given the way the company releases products now. And since everything is a service, they can't build in the kind of security that we really tried to build in when Michael and I were there, and you know they did for the 20 years after the security push. It's just gotten weaker and weaker. Are they investing a lot of money? Sure. Are they making a lot of money off of higher tier products already? Yes. That's why they're investing more money, because they don't want to lose that revenue. Mm-hmm. But I think that Microsoft should seriously look at security much more deeply than they are, because they are that single surface for so many organizations now. And I just don't see them investing as heavily in the technology, the foundations, as they should be. And it's still an afterthought. And I'm going to be weirded out for a long time about the way they handled the Copilot move. So.
Michael?
I'm going to agree with Wes. It's not job number one. It never will be. So let's think about what job number one is at Microsoft today. Job number one at Microsoft today is locking people who have already subscribed into their subscriptions by creating barriers that make it harder and harder for them to leave if they become dissatisfied. They also are trying to find what are the levers they can twist to make those of us who are subscribing pay more for subscriptions that are offering not that much new value. That's job number one. Evidence of this, if you want to see it, is the fact that Microsoft can't seem to get a patch out without creating problems. I don't know if they do any testing beyond using, you know, the canary channels to test products, but it isn't working. Windows 11 24H2 still isn't available for my machine. It's being throttled. It's being throttled because Microsoft knows it's creating problems. If security and quality were any part of the factor, then these things wouldn't be happening. This actually kind of cheats all of us, because the clock for the general availability, for the duration of the support window, begins on the day that they announce general availability. Hmm. It shouldn't start until the day that the last machine is off the throttle, that it's available to everyone. Because for those of us who can't get it yet, we're losing time. The other thing on this whole security thing is, you know, they're doing a whole bunch of just security theater. It's very much like they're sort of the TSA of software security at the moment. There's a whole bunch of theater, like we're not going to give executives their full pay if there's a security incident. Like that affects. Does Satya Nadella notice that he didn't get as much when he got such a great amount of money? And I'm not taking anything away from him. He's got a hard job. But let's not pretend that executives are any more focused on security because of that kind of security theater. Let's get serious. Let's go after the nation state attackers. Let's go after the people that are out there. And the one last thing for Windows users that I want to just mention is, after the CrowdStrike incident, which was related to Microsoft in a way, they're involved in this. If they take the ability of security products to run in the kernel away, which may be the right thing to do, then those of you who are using third-party products that have the ability to run there, you want to be very cautious about what those products are going to look like and how they're going to work in the future, and whether Defender is an alternative that you can go to if it's the last thing, the last security product that's left with kernel access. So that's my take on it. I'm kind of very This just really even bothers me to pretend that it might be job number one.
I know. I kind of wavered about asking you, but I said, no, I needed to. Okay. Now, this is the last question I want to ask. And it's one of those ones you could just give me one word answer if you're really succinct. So what's Microsoft's biggest opportunity, biggest risk, biggest liability? And it can be the same thing for all three, or it could be different. Barry.
Barry.
I want to start with Barry because Barry gave me this question and I thought it was a good
one. Oh, yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
I apologize if my mic is echoing, but I think the answer to all three is, it obviously is AI is one, but I'm going to say E5. Why? Because Microsoft's putting so much features into it, you know, but the scuttlebutt is that not everybody's adopting it. So, you know, I think, you know, Microsoft really wants, you know, if everybody adopts E5, it's a huge benefit for them. You know, yeah, on the other hand, if they don't, then they put, because they're putting all their investment in E5, then that investment is going to waste. So I think, you know, the upshot of that is this may be a good negotiating point for you.
Mm-hmm. Rob Sanfilippo, did you want to join?
Yeah, I took.
I can guess your first answer.
Yeah, I had a few rounds on this question. My first, a lot of people probably thought this, but the answer was Copilot to all three. Right.
Yeah.
The second time I thought a little more, I was like, well, opportunity, Copilot, biggest risk, security, biggest liability, security, and Copilot. So still security and Copilot. But then I was like, all right, let's refine this a little bit. I think opportunity is still Copilot. Risk, though, is that customers won't figure out how to use Copilot. Like, it's very powerful, but they won't understand how to take advantage of it, won't know how to use it, and then they'll give up. And that's why there's things like Copilot Lab, which is now renamed Prompt Gallery. And there'll be many more tools to help users understand how to get the power out of it. But will that happen or not? That's a risk. And then the liability is that Microsoft has to reveal to customers the value that they're getting if there is a good value out of Copilot. And I think the new announcement of Copilot Analytics is going down that path. And there's some previous tools. But really demonstrating to customers, even if they are getting the value out of it, to prove that they're getting the value out of it before they jump ship and say, yeah, we spent too much. It's not doing what you said. We're onto something else now.
Greg, do you have any thoughts as the new guy?
Yeah, I think liability is focus. Microsoft is historically a really good fast follower, but they're chasing a lot of taillights now, whether it's Apple in the devices space or the new data stack. And all of these other companies are much more single-minded in their focus. Microsoft doesn't have the old Windows guide, way to guide it. You add in their tendency to plaster the new marketing name on everything under the sun, Copilot anybody? And it really gets hard for customers to know what's got legs. So I think focus is their biggest liability. Their biggest risk, if you zoom way out, it's the lost generation. People graduating high school and college right now are generation Chrome, G Suite, Zoom, Slack. Every startup in the last 15 years is all in on AWS. This is not a short-term issue because Silicon Valley is a small part of the economy and noobs don't make strategy. But companies grow, and today's new hires, tomorrow's CXO. So I think that lost generation, the biggest opportunity, this is going to be weird. You know, what goes around comes around, and Google now has antitrust woes. Could Microsoft replace Google as the default search engine on iOS? Could Microsoft embrace AI search in a way that Google is afraid to? In other words, Bing, dead or resting? I wonder if there's not an opportunity there. And by the way, if you look up Schadenfreude in the dictionary, at some point you will see Microsoft's legal team reading about Google's antitrust woes.
Indeed. All right. I'm going to stop here.
Mary Jo.
Okay. Go ahead.
I think their biggest risk and liability, I'm going to put them together, is this subscription mindset. I mentioned it a little bit earlier on, mm-hmm. but almost every subscription company
companies that have been in this subscription model gets to this mindset where they think they have their customers locked in and they can do whatever they want to them, abuse them in any way, and they've got the revenue stream coming in. Microsoft needs to seriously think about this model and how it's going to move forward, and that they don't just start to just think of their customers as this constant money supply that they can do anything to. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Okay, that's good. All right. I wanted to stop there because I know we're going to get some questions from people who are listening in today, and we want to save time for those as well. Before we get to those, though, I just wanted to mention some things about our resources. So if you're a member of Directions already, you know you can log in and search our many different reports that we're constantly updating, our licensing referencing sets, and lots more information that we have for you. But if you're not yet a member, you still can check out our blog and our podcast because they are not behind the paywall. They're free. You just need to go to directionsonmicrosoft.com/blog or directionsonmicrosoft.com/podcasts, and you can read and listen to your heart's content. We also have two social media feeds, which you can subscribe to and check out, where we post regularly about not only what we're working on at Directions, but also on some of the tips about products and licensing issues that we want to pass on to enterprise customers. So we are on X at Directions MSFT. And as of last week, we are also on Blue Sky now as Directions on Microsoft.com. So please give us a follow.
Fantastic. Thanks, Mary Jo. Just to follow on to what you were talking about in terms of memberships and resources, one of the advantages of the Directions on Microsoft membership is access to our member portal, where we have detailed licensing guides, product roadmaps, recordings of previous webinars, and a ton of other resources to help you stay up to date and in the know. If you're a member and you need help accessing the portal, just email us at service@directionsonmicrosoft.com. And if you're not a member and you'd like to learn more, please email us at sales@directionsonmicrosoft.com. And next up, our next webinar is Thursday, January 23rd at 10 a.m. Pacific. And the topic is the next wave of Windows and Office migrations, being presented by Rob Helm and Michael Cherry. To learn more about our webinars, visit the member portal or email us at sales@directionsonmicrosoft.com. Microsoft licensing training. If understanding the complex landscape of Microsoft licensing is essential to your role, we do have Microsoft licensing boot camps and EA negotiation workshops that are considered to be industry-leading trainings in this space. We have one more offering this calendar year. We have a virtual session actually next week, December 9th through the 13th, and there's space available if you'd like to join us. And if in-person is more your style, our next offering is January 13th through 15th in Orlando, Florida. And last, before we get into Q&A, I wanted to remind you that we offer advisory and consulting services will help you level the playing field with Microsoft. Everything from strategy assessments to ongoing expert desk support, our industry veterans are here to help. If you want to learn more about our advisory services and how they can benefit your organization, email us at sales@directionsonmicrosoft.com. Sorry, I sped through that. I know that the Q&A is really important to everyone, and I want to make sure that we get to them. So if the team is ready, I'll get started. The first one is for Michael. Michael, do you think it's worth the effort to spend time and effort getting ahead of the 2011 UEFI boot certificate requirement, or do you believe that enterprises should just let it happen?
I'm not sure there's a single answer to that. I think you're going to just have to evaluate what it's going to take and mean to you before you make that decision. I don't think anyone can make that for you.
Okay, thank you. Next question. How are the large capital investments in perpetual licenses converted to subscriptions? This is complicated further with true-up timing on EAs and residual cost calcs. Who wants to take that one?
Yeah, so I'll grab it. The main thing is what you can expect is, for example, Configuration Manager did this first, but it's continued on through System Center and when you're using it with Configuration Manager, and then all of the subscription edition products do the same thing, which is it is just the perpetual product, but software assurance is mandated. So you have to pay SA. And historically, that would have been an option that you would have decided. So ironically, you're paying for software assurance when you're getting diminishing value, and the prices on most of these things have raised. So that's the answer.
Thank you, Wes. And looks like we don't have any other questions coming in. Perhaps your questions for the panel, Mary Jo, answered it for everyone. Is there anything you'd like to say before I close us out?
I'd just like to thank everybody for joining us today, and also to our whole panel of analysts here at Directions on Microsoft for their great contributions. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Looks like we just had one or two sneak in
They did. All right. Okay. One question. Are EAs really going away?
Mary Jo, you want me to get that one, or you want to talk to me?
I'm laughing because it's as Wes says, it's not a simple answer, but there's many parts to it. Go ahead. I'll let you answer.
Yes. So the answer is eventually we can expect that EAs will go away. However, basically, the larger your organization is today, the longer your timeline probably is before you have to worry about it. If you're a small, sub 1,000, you probably want to be mindful of the fact that Microsoft is going to push you heavily towards the Microsoft customer agreement instead. And that's where everyone will have to go at some point in time. And it's important to understand that there's obviously some things you lose that you would have had classically under an EA, like amendments. And the system just doesn't have a mechanism by design to deal with those kinds of things. And the other thing is you lose perpetual software because the MCA does generally not bring perpetual software with it. Everything is subscription by definition. So there's a lot to absorb. And if you really want to dive deeper into that, I would encourage you to attend one of our licensing boot camps because we're spending more and more time talking about EA versus MCA there.
Great point. Thank you, Wes. Next question, do you have any information on watermarking of images within Microsoft 365 Copilot? And also any third-party testing on data not being added to the LLM? Anyone?
I don't know of anybody that's actually doing testing. I think what you're asking is anybody testing to make sure that the data in RAG applications that we talked about earlier, is that actually being added to the LLM, which Microsoft swears up and down is not. So if you use Copilot to talk to, or Microsoft 365 Copilot to talk to SharePoint, Microsoft guarantees that that's not going into any of their public LLMs. Is there anybody testing that? Not that I'm aware of.
I'm going to add something here too, is that when you have to think about all possible ways that your data can get sucked up into an LLM. And I don't mean Copilot. There was a really big, people got all up in arms recently because it was, oh my God, the studios told writers that they wouldn't give the scripts for TV shows, to OpenAI, and they're in it now. And the writers, of course, are all up in arms. They're talking about, their proper compensation, everything else. And turns out the studios didn't do it. There was another site that was just a fan site that was devoted towards generating closed captions of shows. And so they had this whole library of closed captioning for TV shows that had aired, in an era before you frequently had closed captioning available. And that site got scraped. So it wasn't. It was data leakage, I guess is the way you want to call it. It wasn't like, Copilot didn't grab my data because it was, because they had internal access to my SharePoint. It's like, oh no, we happened to share this data with somebody and they downloaded some things and it was put on something that was publicly available and it got searched. And that, this is why I talked earlier about doing all the hard work of securing your data, is because there's so many avenues by which things can be added to an LLM that you don't want, and they don't. Security through obscurity doesn't work. So,
and I I'll just add that you need to, I think, as part of this thinking about how your data is secured, you really do need to create some sort of a hierarchy and understand, like, where are your trade secrets? Where are your, you know, where are the things that are the most important? And are they properly protected? And the watermarking comes into play here. Are they properly contained within the correct intellectual property protection? Are they trademarked? Are they copyrighted? And then are they watermarked? Or is there something that you have that identifies the creation, when they were created, that you were the creator, and that kind of thing? And so that's part of your thinking about the security. It's not just turning on the ACLs or the protection, right? It's understanding the hierarchy of the data and its importance.
Thank you, Michael, and thanks, Jim. And I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Thank you to Mary Jo and for all of our analysts. I hope everyone can join us for our next webinar on January 23rd. I hope you all have a great rest of your day.